Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta greet them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, whites, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the best and longest running dedicated G.I. Joe comics podcast. If you're new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. Today, we are continuing our look at the disavowed era of G.I. Joe with G.I. Joe America's Elite issues 15 through 18. Which were published by Devil's Due September 2006 through December 2006. And this is where the Joe Casey run concludes. If you are reading along in trades, this is collected in the 2007 America's Elite trade paperback number 3, which is called In Sheep's Clothing from Devil's Due. That collects 13 through 18. Those same issues are also collected in the 2014 America's Elite Volume 3 from IDW. Now, with that admin out of the way, it's time to introduce my co-host. It's the Real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hey, Tim. Before we got started proper on these issues, I just wanted to do a fact check from the last episode where we were talking about that 3D projection of the rock as Ray was planning his attack. And we were discussing that a little bit. And then I was looking at the Datadesk handbook, which is from October 2005, and noticed that actually features a double page spread on the rock, exactly the kind of thing we said that we would like to see. And in fact, I think the visual that was created for that double page spread is the same one that was converted into a hologram for issue 14 when that appeared.
Thank you for the fact check. I was thinking that issue 1 of America's Elite, if it had been double-sized with some pinups or more pinups, that would have been a good place for this two-page data desk spread as a mirror for the 1982 G.I. Joe issue 1, which double-sized and has a cutaway of the pit.
Mm.
And then everyone would know, you know, going into this story. I mean, maybe putting in issue 1 would have revealed it too soon, or issue 0. But based on our confusion and how much fun it would be to sort of follow along with where the base is being infiltrated in this story, it makes all kinds of logical sense that it goes in the data disk. But from a reader perspective, it really wants to be in the regular issues.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been great if they'd included it in issue 14. So you almost do the see that diagram being projected as they plan the assault, and then you do a page turn and you see, you know, a much bigger version of it. That would have worked really well. I'm not planning to actually cover the Datadesk handbook as a separate episode. It is largely, you know, the same entries that we're seeing in the back of the issues, and it's nothing too exciting. I'd say it's kind of what you'd expect in terms of just a picture of the characters and then a little write up. It does have quite a nice cover, Nelson Blake, which is a homage of the original yearbook cover from Michael Golden, which I think is probably the cover is probably the highlight of the book, to be honest.
Yeah, I have the data desk, and for three reasons, I'm not really interested in flipping through the Devil's Due G.I. Joe quote handbook comics. The sort of extra stuff, the biographical stuff they've added for characters is less interesting to me. They're well designed, but over designed, you know, like the tech font and like the red text on the light gray and the blue text on the light gray, like the letters page. They're a little hard to read in terms of layout and design. I love, you know, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe and DC Who's Who. I love them as objects. And I know someone who loves them and reads them. I can never quite make it through a whole, you know, profile on someone. I think even when in the Marvel run, starting at issue 108, there were those backup pages with sort of expanded G.I. Joe dossiers. I loved the idea, and I think I read them because I was just sort of hungry for G.I. Joe. But, you know, I'd read all the issues of the comic, so a, like, you know, two-column summary of everything Spirit had done or everything Scarlet had done, I sort of nodded, like, yeah, I know. I think those were helpful for people who were newer to the series or hadn't collected every back issue. Let's get to this Joe Casey arc.
So this issue is brought to us by the creative team of script Joe Casey, pencils Josh Meadows, inks Richard Zajac, colors Jason Jensen for 15 through 17, and Rob Ruffalo on 18, letters Brian J. Crowley, military advisor Phil Kost, and edited by Mike O'Sullivan. Tim, do you want to talk us through the covers?
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Each of these issues has just the one cover. There are no variants or second prints. 15 is a bold, just head and shoulders shot of masked, not hooded, Cobra Commander. Which is a contrast from the previous issues where we've been focusing on him and his mask on the covers. And this cover, he's looking slightly over us, and the camera is at his shoulder height and looking slightly up at him. Reflected in his face mask is the White House, and on the top of his helmet is the reflection of the Stars and Stripes, which is behind him, burning. This cover is penciled and inked by Tony Akins, who I know of because he drew a chunk of the Brian Azzarello New 52 Wonder Woman run. Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang did that 3-year run on Wonder Woman, which is quite good. Cliff Chang would draw 3 issues and then would take 3 issues off. And Tony Akins was one of the guys who subbed for him. And he's also done Fables and a lot of other things, at, you know, DC and Dark Horse. I'm sure if I say this, I'll be proven wrong. I feel like this is his only G.I. Joe work. The other 3 covers are penciled by Tim Seeley or penciled and inked by Tim Seeley. I think it's possible the cover to 15 is only penciled and then very heavily digitally colored, but 16 is Snake Eyes, Head and Shoulders, looking at us with a dark background, and no sword, no throwing star, also no Uzi. So here are 2 covers in a row where I wonder if Devil's Due on purpose chose not to include guns and machine guns as per the evolving Hasbro preference. This cover to 16... on the top, it says, "The Commando is back." And on the bottom, there's a quote from a media outlet called Comics Waiting Room. And the quote is, "Perfectly executed." And this Snake Eyes costume here is the version 1 from 82, where he's got a collar and sort of a ribbed, you know, long sleeve sweater. So the idea here is that, you know, the ninja half of Snake Eyes is gone.
I've got 2 observations around this Snake Eyes cover to 16. The first is it's a bit of a companion piece to the Storm Shadow one from number 8. It's that kind of torso head shot. The Storm Shadow one is very sort of desaturated. It's got a white background. He's almost lost into the light, whereas Snake Eyes is a dark figure against a dark background. So we're sort of getting the yin and yang of Storm Shadow light and dark.
Yeah, you could put these two covers next to each other and they'd make a nice diptych.
And the second one is that online, on Comic Art Fans, I found an image by Josh Meddles of Snake Eyes, which is virtually identical to this. And I wondered whether this was potentially his take on this cover, which maybe was rejected in favour of an alternate by Tim Seeley. I guess we'll never know exactly, but it's interesting that there's a very similar version.
For those of us that can't see it, is there anything about the Josh Meddles cover that isn't as good or compelling?
It's a little bit less straight on, so it's a little bit less of a hero shot. He's lost a little bit more into the shadow. So maybe they felt that they just needed a little bit more of a sort of a pop hero shot to the image.
Interesting.
Or it could be that you know, maybe he saw this cover and decided to try and draw his own take and thought that it might be, you know, a good fun thing that he'll you know, could sell on a convention or something along those lines. Also, interestingly enough, the original pencils to this cover of 16, much like the Storm Shadow, are zoomed out. So we actually do see more of Snake Eyes' body, including him holding an Uzi, whereas obviously the printed version is zoomed in, which is the same as what happened to the Storm Shadow image for number 8. I think possibly the zoomed in version is more of an interesting angle.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, I have just seen. Yes, I have just found Meddles while you were talking. I just found his Snake Eyes cover that looks like it could be. Oh, I'm looking at this Comic Art Fans for the Josh Meddles G.I. Joe cover. And in fact, in the description, it does say rejected cover for Devils Do G.I. Joe series. That description comes from the owner of the art who has posted it. So not necessarily from the artist himself, but there is some suggestive evidence. Yes, interesting. Okay, the cover to issue 17 is the Baroness, and she's holding up a machine gun, having just broken some glass between you and her with the butt of her machine gun, and her leg is up, her knee is up, as if she's also going to kick it or hop through. This cover is penciled by Tim Seeley and inked by Robert Atkins. And do we have some audio on this, Mark?
Yeah, let's hear from Sam Wells, who talked about the whole circumstances around producing this cover.
Yeah, this one was embarrassing. Like, so we had this amazing cover by Adam Hughes. I don't know if we had ever worked with Adam Hughes before this, and getting him to do a cover was just, you know, like it was a bucket list item for so many people at Devils Do. Like, oh my God, we got Adam Hughes to do an amazing Baroness cover. And the notes that came back, I think originally on this one was, sorry, I've got a plane going overhead. It's too sexual with her mouth open. So as embarrassing as that was to have to go back to him and be like, hey, there's notes from the licensor, the revised cover got scrapped as well. Like when he closed her mouth, tilted her head, and then they're like, nope, still too sexy. And that's, I don't know if you know this, but like, that's whatever is going on in that person's head, you know? That's, so it's whatever was in that person's head projected onto the image that they were looking at the time. That's where we got. And it's a shame too, that this cover never got published, except it did at IDW. What was it, like issue 2, issue 4 or something like that? They used it as their retail incentive cover.
Something like that, yeah.
Wasn't so bad after all.
Yeah. And I actually, I don't remember who it was, but I got a call from Hasbro after, like, the license was over with. We still had a relationship with them because we were still doing, I think, D&D and whatever. But I got a call from somebody on the Joe brand, And they're like, hey, can we get contact info for Adam Hughes? Like, yeah, sure. Let me send you that email. And that's what it was for, was to get that cover for IDW. Yeah, so on the screen now is what Tim cranked out in an afternoon for us in frustration. Everyone frustrated. Us, Hughes, possibly the fans not getting the book they had hoped for. And as it's been mentioned, instead of signing his name, he wrote sorry, the same way that he signed Seeley there on the cover.
Also, I should add, if a comic book is solicited with one cover and then the publisher doesn't publish the comic with that cover, even though the direct market of comic book stores, comics are bought non-returnable. In that case, the stores can return all unsold copies for their money back. And so that would be sort of the triple whammy where a publisher might get stung by a deal going wrong.
And I can say that Joe collectors don't return their covers. So we didn't see any of these coming back, not to my knowledge. And that would have been, I would have been the one aware of this. We didn't get any of these books back. And I think the thing that helped us was that we weren't putting it on like a retailer incentive cover or like a more expensive book. It was going on the normal book, you know. Had it been like an $8, like cardstock fancy, like you got to order like 600 copies to get this one, you know, like we would have gotten those back. But luckily, people were just like, all right, it's Baroness, it's in the slab, let's move on to the next issue.
And Sam Wells, for this issue, is the credited assistant publisher. So that's where he was at that point. I think it's a fun cover if you know the whole story. And I appreciate that Seeley being, you know, there as a staff artist could, you know, could pitch in. I don't think it's a great cover. It feels like sort of the pose of the Baroness is it's sort of neither fully having just bashed something and neither like just a sexy, cool standing there pinup shot cover pose. It sort of seems caught between two things. I think the drawing's okay.
And there's also almost a third cover that exists for this issue, because the sort of there's an original tease in the back of some of the books. So for example, in the back of issue 15, which has an image of the Baroness in a orange jumpsuit in handcuffs, which says she's coming after you, which you'd think maybe that might be a future cover with the Baroness on it, but in the end I think this is only used as a teaser.
Yeah, that is that image, that this full page inside back cover to issue 15 is signed Tim Seeley. It's definitely penciled and digitally colored and not inked. And then there's sort of a shadow over her of vertical prison bars acting both as a thing in front of her, casting a shadow, and also a thing behind her as a graphical element. Yeah, I think that's a really good teaser image and not quite a good cover. So if that was the calculus, I would agree. I'm also always excited whenever there's any original art that just gets used once and doesn't have to be sort of show up, you know, again. It's sort of if you have every issue, you get this little extra special. You know, if there's a collection, I'd like them to include it. But just because you draw something as a teaser or pinup for the next issue doesn't mean it has to be.
And funny enough, it struck me sort of looking through some of the issues of G.I. Joe, and particularly the IDW run, that there are an awful lot of Baroness covers and an awful lot of sort of generic pinup type posing Baroness covers on the variant covers from IDW, which made me decide to make a little jingle that when we come across a Baroness cover, we can remind ourselves of just how many there are.
Why are there so many covers of Baroness? 'Cause she's on the other side. Cobra are villains, my only conclusion.
The costume makes us wide-eyed. So we've been shown, and some people think she is fit, though it is wrong blatantly. Someday we'll complete it, the cover collection, the Baroness, her leather, and me.
The cover for issue 18 reuses as a background the cover for issue 14, which was that Phil Noto image of the Phoenix Guard standing with a sunset sky behind them in the American flag, which itself was a reference, Mark pointed out, to the cover to issue zero.
One.
Issue one, not issue zero. And here on the cover to issue 18, the new artwork, which takes up, four-fifths of this, is penciled by Tim Seeley. And it is Scrap Iron, Zorana, Copperhead, Wild Weasel, and Firefly, all holding weapons. Except for Copperhead, who's just got fists, but I'll count that. And they are bursting through a hole in the cover with, you know, a torn paper edge around them, and a white background is behind them. And this cover is a reference to the Gil Kane cover to the 1975 giant-sized X-Men, which had the, quote, new X-Men bursting out, and behind them, reacting in surprise, the, quote, old X-Men. What I really appreciate about this is that Seeley did not do a precise cover swipe, a precise cover homage. So the poses of these five Cobra agents are not pulled from the 7 new X-Men. He's arranging them compositionally the way that he wants. And I think that's the way to do a cover swipe, and I've gotten really bored of cover swipes because by the time I end this sentence, like 17 more comics will have been published where someone is redrawing the John Byrne Days of Future Past cover. And I actually think that Marvel and DC should just do, and like Dynamite should do, a cover stunt where for a month, just every single cover they publish is just like the exact same swipe. It's like 25 different artists are doing like that same John Byrne cover swipe, and some of them are Spider-Man, and some of them are the X-Men, and some of them are like Red Sonja, because I just want to break it, and so people will finally get as tired of it as me. So kudos to Tim Seeley.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to suggest that just as a crazy out there, wacky idea, that for a month, everyone draws an original cover that doesn't swipe any previous covers that in existence. That would be pretty crazy.
That's a stunt in and of itself. Original composition variant. Something that I really like about the cover to 18 is this is a reminder to me. I've said before that when I think of G.I. Joe, I think of color, and I see G.I. Joe as color. I think of color schemes. So when I think of Scrap Iron, I'm thinking of that dark blue and that maroon. And when I think of Copperhead, I'm thinking of the contrast of the Caucasian with the green and the sort of lime green or the turquoise, right? When I think of Wild Weasel, I think of that red maroon with that little bit of blue. And same with Zorana and Firefly. And recently in G.I. Joe, we haven't gotten a nice big dose, a nice big burst in America's Elite of, you know, like color variety, color schemes that pops. And, you know, the Phoenix Guard are all in dark gray, and the coloring in a lot of the issues overall has been, you know, more rendered and modern. And this cover is rendered and modern, but is just a little bit more sort of 1980s for me in its feel. You know, like Cobra is flamboyant, you know, like you think of the Empire in Star Wars, just the original Star Wars movie, 1977, and you just have black and white and gray. You have black TIE fighter pilots and white stormtroopers, Darth Vader's in black, and then a bunch of old Brits with receding hairlines, and they're in like gray tunics. And that's it. And that's a contrast to the rebellion, which is colorful, you know, like Luke's, all the X-Wing pilots. And I love this reminder that, G.I. Joe in its prime is all of these colors and all these really great color schemes. I'm thinking of, you know, Ron Rudat and other Hasbro people who came up with them.
I was going to mention as well, Tim, that as well as obviously the obvious giant size X-Men homage going on here, there's also a broader cover design type, which is sort of characters busting through the cover, not necessarily specifically referencing the X-Men, which started with possibly Superman issue 9 all the way back in the 1940s. So it's a long-standing tradition to have characters busting through the cover.
That's great. And I think that itself comes from the circus performer, you know, fairground festival, you know, vaudevillian notion of someone holding like a giant hoop with an image printed on it, and then someone live in front of you up on a stage or at the fairgrounds, you know, bursting through it, actually sort of jumping through a piece of paper, and you know, and maybe it's like some strongman and there's his name on the fabric or the paper or an image of him, and then the real guy pops out behind him, and you know, the audience gasps and oohs and ahs.
Yeah, because I guess there's that famous image of Batman with Robin jumping through that hoop with the paper and bursting through. But I guess the reason that that image was you know, used at the time was because that is a thing that actually used to happen, that was part of the zeitgeist of the time. People would, you know, reveal themselves by jumping through paper and bursting out. And
yeah, I actually, three times this morning before I sat down with my headphones in front of my microphone, there was a giant ring with a paper image of me or my name in block letters, and I got to burst through it. But there's no crowd in my home, so I was just doing this for myself. And then I thought, oh, it's time to record the episode.
Right. Okay, so back to the story. Last time when we were talking, we left off as General Ray was beginning his plan with the Phoenix Guards to launch an invasion on the Pit. So this is where we pick up.
Plot breakdown.
Cobra Commander schemes with the President to get G.I. Joe replaced, with the Phoenix Guard beginning their training to invade the Rock. Hawk returns to the Joe team back at the Rock, while Storm Shadow takes Chabang away to try to get him healed. Stalker confronts General Coulton about keeping the Baroness's capture a secret just as the power is cut, signalling that the Phoenix Guard invasion of the Rock has started. The Joes are caught by surprise and on the defence. Coulton, Kamakura, Snake Eyes and Scarlet escape to a hidden panic room. The Phoenix Guard takes control of the Rock, though with some Joes captured and others unaccounted for. Garrett Friedlow, aka Cobra Commander, has gained access to the data desk, which contains information about Baroness and her baby. General Ray gains access to the Joes' data desk files, which cross-matches Phoenix Guard members with identified threats, and discovers that the Phoenix Guard is actually a group of Cobra agents in disguise: Zarana, Wild Weasel, Copperhead, Scrap Iron, and Firefly. General Ray confronts Scrap Iron and is helped by Snake Eyes and Spirit in taking him down. The Baroness escapes, knocking out Zarana in the process. Coulton is able to reach the President and explain what has happened. The President then finds the corpse of the real Garrett Friedlow and a pre-recorded message from Cobra Commander with a warning. He knows every weakness of the government's infrastructure and is more than happy to exploit them. Duke returns to the G.I. Joe base just in time to help in the fight back. He takes out Copperhead and Wild Weasel, while Firefly is able to make a getaway when the backup finally arrives. The President takes full responsibility for the mess, and Coulton promises that the G.I. Joe team will be ready to step up for whatever comes next. Finally, Cobra Commander pulls together Cobra cells from across the country as he towers over a baby. He says, "You represent the ultimate conquest, the future." Dun dun dun. What a note to leave it on. So much there. Tim, where would you like to start?
So I did not read these issues as they came out. I did know the reveal. I did know who Phoenix Guard was. I'd forgotten very specifically who was who. But, you know, several issues before we got to these four issues, I remember seeing an ad for future issues with the Phoenix Guard, and I thought, wasn't there a thing about them? And then I thought about it. Oh, right. Yeah, my friend who was reading this comic at the time in 2006 said, you know, when the reveal happened, when issue 18 with the Cobra agents on the cover, like, oh, yeah, they've been in disguise. So I wish that I could have read this organically without the spoiler. I won't ever know how I would have reacted. I think I would have thought it was really fun and really cool, and I would have, you know, tipped my hat to Joe Casey for doing something different and fun. In terms of the actual writing of it, it strikes me as the kind of thing that kids may have thought of when they were young playing with G.I. Joe. You know, like you see some episodes of the cartoon and Zorana and the Baroness are in disguise in several episodes, and Major Blood is in disguise in, I think, the first episode or the second episode of the animated series. And, you know, sort of in the air in the 1980s, you know, like the Mission Impossible revival, and who's the guy on A-Team? Is it Face? Is he in disguise? Anyway.
Hannibal, he's the disguise man.
Hannibal, thank you. And I didn't watch, my mom didn't let me watch the A-Team.
Oh, wow.
Because it said it had guns, but we could have watched MacGyver.
I never shot anyone.
Right. I think this thing that Casey is doing is both a fun bit of long-term plotting that a writer like him might do on this series, and that a Larry Hama is not going to do, because Hama makes it up as he goes along. And also this is what I'm trying to say about, like, it was in the air. This sort of feels to me like Joe Casey is playing with his toys. Not literally Joe Casey as a kid is playing with his toys, or Joe Casey as a grown-up writing this comic is playing with his toys, but he's getting to do a thing with this comic that I don't know that you could do in X-Men, you know, or in Wildcats. I don't know that you could quite do it the same way, but it's much more nuts and bolts here. Like, well, a lot of Joes aren't around, and some of these Cobra agents, we haven't seen their faces. And yeah, I got a guy in the White House, and give him different names and costumes. So I think it's fun. That said, my overall comment for this arc is I like that Josh Meadors is a talented person who draws. His actual drawing is pretty good. His storytelling and page layout are not there yet, which I'll get into more. And I think what I see in Joe Casey's writing here, and this is a phrase that I don't think fully sells it, so maybe you and I will help me figure out how to phrase this by the end of the episode. This arc strikes me as very plotty, very, very plot-ish. Like, I can see the plot. You know, it's like, Joe Casey has these bad guys in disguise, and they're revealed. And Cobra Commander has infiltrated the White House. And I'm saying this a little bit as a negative, and you know, sometimes we read Hama G.I. Joe stories or read issues in a row and they feel like they meander because he's making it up as he goes along. Like, not enough happens in an issue, or the first couple pages of an issue don't add anything from the previous issue. And then all of a sudden there'll be an issue, which is the greatest issue, you know, of all the issues. And this America's Elite run is much more consistent, which I like. But I'm very aware of the sort of mechanics, like the decisions that Casey is making ahead of time, like, because you'd need to plan this ahead. Like, no, these are bad guys in disguise. And like, we all knew something was up with the Phoenix Guard several issues ago. You know, the question was what? And I appreciate the big swing he's taken. It's very fun. It's very appealing to the kid in all of us. Like, wait, the bad guys, and they've got cool new names and cool new costumes. And yet it still feels like it happened too fast. Mm. That Cobra Commander, sort of when you blinked, when he was off panel, when he was out of the series for a little while, oh, he's like the number four guy in the country. And I feel like these five specific Cobras, it's sort of too weird of a grouping, you know, like if it was five Dreadnoughts, it wouldn't make sense, but that makes a kind of sense. I don't know that Firefly is a team player here, and Wild Weasel is a pilot, and Zarana is a Dreadnought and has different priorities than, you know, like Scrap Iron is an inventor, but I feel like he could be a mercenary, and Copperhead is a specialist. Wild Weasel is a specialist, and I feel like you could not get Firefly to do this. So I love the idea, and I think the execution is good, but it feels a little compressed to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there to unpack, Tim.
I've talked for a long time.
I'll linger on a couple of the ideas you've said there. One, which is to mention that the mystery of the reveal of the Phoenix Guard, and I think it's in the back of issue 17 or something. Then there's a reveal of the cover to issue 18, but all of the characters are sort of put as silhouettes with question marks. And on the Diamond Previews website showing the solicit at the time, that is the image that they used. So sort of trying to protect the reader from that reveal of seeing the cover months in advance, that you only see a partial version of the cover with the spoiler blocked out. So they went to make some efforts to kind of, you know, let the reveal happen on the page, which is nice for people there, you know, experiencing it in real time. Yeah, I think there's an element there about plot first and plot mechanics and it being slightly less organic, but also wrapping up very shortly. It's clear that Casey is someone who has planned out his story arc, so he will have a very clear idea of, you know, what he wants to happen within almost probably issue by issue before he comes to the detail of the writing. So it's a very different style, as you say, to the way that someone who writes making it up as they go along would come at it. Something about that sort of the compressed kind of it all happening very quickly aspect for me is that it, from a story perspective, it felt like Cobra Commander was in a very sort of powerful place and quite a long way from being discovered. And he almost sort of like shoots his wad a little bit early there, that he sort of just blows everything up with the Phoenix Guard reveal. And if maybe he'd taken his time being a bit more cautious, being a bit more politic about it, he could have just, you know, used political influence to just quietly unwind G.I. Joe, put Phoenix Guard there in their stead, and, you know, continue to eke out his level of political influence as the president's right hand man, rather than just blowing everything up and revealing and then, you know, running away to the next plot. Let's say. You also touched on Josh Meadows' art, and we'll probably cover this more. My thought, just looking at the art for these four issues, was that comparing it to, for instance, just the handful of pages that he did for that Hunter for Cobra Commander issue, you could tell that he was investing a lot of time and energy onto each page, each panel there, you know, drawing the detail of the vines and the even, you know, snake scales and that kind of level of detail. And here I suspect that he's much, much more rushed and is probably much more under the cosh to just get the job done. And perhaps if he had luxury of a bit more time, he would be approaching things in a slightly different way. My other high level is, because I didn't really talk about, you know, my overall feeling to it, is I liked it. I did. I thought it was a different G.I. kind of G.I. Joe series. And I was looking at the Yojo write-up, which is probably by Josh Eggebeen. And in sort of part of the summary for that last issue, it says, Phoenix Guard, Baroness, General Ray, Duke, and caught in the middle of the G.I. Joe team members that are still standing, one of the most ambitious G.I. Joe stories ever told comes to its violent conclusion. And I think that's probably quite fair. It does feel like an ambitious story, a different kind of story to ones that we've seen before. It doesn't feel like we're sort of just treading back over, old reheated stories, which can sometimes feel the case. It does feel new and different and exciting and a real sort of sense of threat, peril, consequences around the story. And, a lot of mystery there, and we've still got this ongoing sort of question mark around, like, Ray, who is he, what's going to happen next with him now that this whole thing is unraveled, with him trying to do the right thing at the center of it, but being somewhat disastrous for him.
You want to get into the issues?
Yeah.
I like the card game in issue 15. It's a fun, both the sort of the first half of it that's friendly, and then the second half with Hawk. I like the writing of it. The staging is really boring. And if your response is, well, how do you make a scene of three people sitting around a table holding very, very small bits exciting? The answer is not like this. And I'm not saying it has to be exciting, but it can be dynamic. And so, just as a little thought exercise, page 1, 2, 3, 4, skipping the ad, 5, 6, 7. So the page after the credits, which starts with a straight-on shot of the three Joes in one-point perspective with no background, and then this over-the-shoulder shot from Kamakura with one-point perspective for the background, and then Shipwreck with no background, which is basically one-point perspective. Spirit Iron Knife with no background, which is one-point perspective. And then the final panel with Shipwreck with the cigar in his mouth and Roadblock with a background, but one-point perspective. And then the thing repeats on the next page where, and there is technically that small panel on the bottom of the next page with Hawk in his wheelchair is not one-point perspective because there's a diagonal there, but it's like a fake two-point perspective. And comparing these drawings to that rejected cover that we referred to, which we're looking at it on comic art fans, which is this quite striking black and white inked image of Snake Eyes head, shoulders, and torso right down to his waist with a specific light source. That is a drawing by someone who can really draw, right? Like the textures and the stippling and the shadows. It's quite lovely. It's a little more aggressive. It looks like Mark Silvestri. It looks like David Finch. It looks more than I want G.I. Joe to look, but it feels very at home with, comic art in the mid-2000s. But Medawar's is poses and storytelling. It's like, yes, he can do eyebrows up and eyebrows down. But there's just all of these issues just have a lot of close-ups of heads and cropped heads and shoulders. And then when it comes time for action, someone's jumping, someone's rappelling, someone's kicking, someone's swinging. They're just not elegant. They don't have an exciting rhythm. There are some awkward compositional choices and overlaps. And so this scene is representative of that for me, the sort of like stiff and stale quality. And then it gets sort of a step further in that direction. So now I'm...
Can I just make one comment on that scene? There's a little error detected in this scene as well. Roadblock says, "Hey, Kamakura, you sure you don't want to play? That mask could be an advantage when you're bluffing." And Kamakura isn't wearing a mask. That's all. Tim, please continue.
I think he's not referring to... I think it's sort of like that mask that you normally wear. I didn't read this as a mistake. I hear what you're saying. Okay, still in issue 15 on page 16, when Ray and these other couple of Phoenix Guard people are doing this test, and there's this page where Ray's holding a stopwatch and it says 1 minute 28 seconds. And then there's this panel underneath it with targets for target practice. I sort of lost track of where they are. Like, wait, are they inside or are they outside? Did they go from inside to further inside? Did they go from outside to inside? Are they on a roof? And then on the next page, when, forgive me, the Phoenix Guard guy with the night vision goggles on the next page, who's got the full mask and the helmet, in that first panel, it's his arm lifting up a floor hatch, and he throws a grenade at these target practice targets. And it's like, where is he coming from? And I realized some of what I'm losing track of is like, who's inside and who's outside, and like, what's sky? And this happens again later on.
If I interject at that, just, you know, while you're on this scene, that it does, even if you're kind of a little bit confused about what's going on, the kind of the end of that sequence kind of, you know, lays it out for you almost literally, that they're in this big expanse of ground sort of surrounded by rocks or, you know, hills or whatever. And it looks like they've kind of like drawn out on the ground the layout of the of a floor plan of the rock. So it's like a two-dimensional version of the rock drawn out on the ground, and they're sort of walking through the room. So they're, you know, acquainting themselves with the layout, so that then when they go to assault the rock proper, they know exactly what the orientation is of where they're, you know, where they are when, as they're moving through the space.
Yeah, from general context, I get it. This is a training mission. There's this panel where they're looking at like a layout, and it says the rock, top secret. I don't think Medor's strength is always tracking where people are in a space while also juggling dynamic action. I think he can do one or the other. It's like it ends up being boring if he's tracking them really well. Once he's doing a lot of exciting poses, like compositions get weaker, and I don't, it's not as clear to me where everyone is. Yeah. So jumping to issue 16, here's another, okay. The first page of issue 16, Friedlow's having dinner with his wife and kid, and his phone rings, and he says, looks like that security report I requested has finally come in. And security report is bold and in italicized. So that's like, looks like that G.I. Joe kill mission that I authorized. he's already standing up, and he says, I need to go. If you were to erase all the word balloons on this panel, you would have no sense that like he's being stiff and sort of ignoring her, and she's having an outburst. And the sense that the kid is like embarrassed or ashamed, I just happened to look at my copy of How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way an hour ago. And, you know, the pages where John Buscema is doing comic book stick figures and Stan Lee is describing how some of them have oomph and some of them are dynamic and have rhythm and others don't. And that's what I see here. You know, like okay, Friedlow can be in another... His head can be in the clouds. He can be in another world. He can be ignoring his wife, denying the reasonable, you know, quality of her feelings, and he's just on a mission. Yeah, I need more acting. I need more acting here. This art feels very, you know, not like Image, but like sort of the people who were trying to do Image in 1993, 1994. Like a lot of detail and a lot of cross-hatching and stippling and hatching and, you know, like furrowed brows and like small, intense eyes and gritted teeth. You know, you turn the page and there's some generic Joe with like an open mouth, and then Ray is yelling, Phoenix Guard, engage! And there's just a lot of like feeling of grit, but yeah.
I guess at this period, you're beginning to get into that era with like the Brian Michael Bendis and stuff, and the, you know, more dialogue heavy, writer driven stories, and a lot of, you know, talking heads, lots of panels on pages of, you know, zippy dialogue. And, you know, it's difficult to make that exciting as an artist, but also not every artist necessarily can do those more sort of mundane things well and make them exciting.
It, as a comparison, just grab any SL Gallant IDW issue of G.I. Joe, and you will see, you know, eyebrows up and torsos turned and heads looking, turning around, and, you know, hands out and fingers, palms turned up, and acting. You'll see acting. You'll see a lot of acting in his poses, in his faces.
Art aside, though, it is an interesting little plot point that they only linger on for a page, and this is this idea that Friedlow, you know, Cobra Commander as Friedlow, is sort of passing himself off there, and to the extent that he's also sort of he's living his private life and these more domestic aspects around his you know, wife and, well, ex-wife and child, a little bit creepy and cruel.
Yeah, I thought it was a good note, but I got a little confused because it sort of felt like a flashback. Like, well, work has always been more important than family, and that's why Cobra Commander targeted him and replaced him. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe he's just an invention. Maybe, you know, I mean, if Cobra and Cobra Commander are advanced enough to use the Zartan technology for this mask, did they also just fake all the paperwork? And this guy just suddenly existed with a fake history, you know, at age 30 or 40, and then he gets a job in the White House. You know, the second one is only slightly more implausible than the first one. So I like the idea of this scene, but I actually thought I needed more of it, considering what a risky, high stakes mission it would be for Cobra Commander to have done this. You know, there's so many Cobra schemes in animated episodes where he is talking to someone about what they're going to do. Destro, Baroness, or in season two, Serpentor is talking to, let's say, Cobra Commander about what he's doing better, or Dr. Mindbender about what he's going to do. And this happens a lot in Hama comics, where the Cobra Commander, the Cobra Brass are maneuvering. And in the later IDW issues, there's a lot of Cobra Commander talking to Dr. Mindbender. I think there's too much. And I think as great as the surprise was that Cobra Commander had made it all the way to the White House, I think I needed more track laid to buy it. So I like this scene with Friedlow's wife and kid, but I sort of needed like one of these scenes each issue where it sort of gets worse, right, you know, where each one is a flashback to like the way that the 25-cent issue was tracking over the 6 months Spirit Iron Knife's mission and catching up to now. Like, oh, can we catch up to sort of how Cobra Commander did this? There's the scene, we're in issue 16 on pages 5 and 6, where Roadblock's fighting one of the Phoenix Guard guys and one of the other Phoenix Guard people sort of strangling someone, has a gun up to their head, and then there's that big yellow orange panel with a bright light, and I had a hard time following this. And this is another example, and I will stop pointing them out, but these two pages here, I had a hard time, partly because in this scene Roadblock's costume is the same color as the Phoenix Guard. Everyone in the scene just has this same like dark gray, dark blue clothing,
right?
And it's like, okay, I see two people in a hallway. I see Roadblock doing something with Copperhead as a Phoenix Guard guy. I don't know what's happening, right? He's tackling him or something. And then there's a punch, right? And then there's this rather, it's hard to follow. It's like, yes, I can. There are two Joes here and two Phoenix Guard people here, right? One's a big black guy, one's a woman. And then there's two white guys, and they all have different costumes. I should be able to follow this a lot more easily. But when I read this, I sort of couldn't tell, wait, what's happening with the grenade? Like, wait, who's getting hit by the grenade? And then in the panel after, it's hard to follow. Hard to follow.
Okay, so Colton, Snake Eyes, and Scarlet initially sort of run away to a hidey hole, which is top secret and nobody else knows about apart from Colton. So I don't know how great a rendezvous point it is. There seems to be a gap in the logic there somewhere. But they get away, and then Cobra Commander as Friedlow is in Washington, D.C. At his laptop, pulling up the Baroness's file. There's a couple of folders there on his desktop. Project Y, Vaughan Wilder, Wilder Vaughan being the Red Shadow, and Dr. Scott Stevens, who I don't know if that means anything. And then...
Wait, who is the serious man in that issue of...
That is someone else.
That wasn't Scott Stevens. This is a very serious man. Am I just inventing it because it's an alliteration?
No, it's Scott Sturgis.
All right, but I can be forgiven because they sound really similar.
So yes, you are thinking of Scott Sturgis, the bald investigative journalist from Scott Sturgis is a Reasonable Man, issue 26. Not him.
okay.
Not him. So Cobra Commander's gone into Project Y, and with the picture of an ultrasound overlapping on the Baroness pictures, I guess he says, of course, I guess the implication is that he's finding out about the Baroness's baby, which they build on a little bit later.
The final page of... All right, so Duke is making his way back.
Mm-hmm. And having a little mini romance at the same time.
hold on that. we're in 16. We're not in 17 yet. The final panel of 16 is the exterior of the rock, but it sort of doesn't look like the rock. I mean, it looks like it. This is tough because the rock is just a mountain, and so you have almost half this panel taken up by smoke. And this little bit of like yellow on the bottom where there must be some light or flame coming from the inside. And then also on the top right, and also more smoke coming from somewhere else. And I look up this panel, and knowing that Devil's Due has taken some larger drawings and zoomed in on them for covers, I sort of wondered if this was a larger drawing and they zoomed in for some reason. Now, I don't actually think they did. The quality of the line does not look like that. But I think this is just me picking on Josh Medors's compositional choices again, because, you know, the shock we're supposed to feel with Duke that the rock has been compromised, that's under attack, falls flat for me here because I sort of don't know what I'm looking at in the final panel.
Yeah, it's a weird, given that it's almost a splash page of some rock and smoke, it's not very exciting, but also I guess we can read between the lines and see that it will be the rock, but it's not very exciting, and also I guess that surprising, shocking reveal might be shocking to Duke, but not really to us as the reader, because we already know that the rock is under assault.
Yeah, and then I was thinking, does the camera need to pull out so we can see more of the rock, and does the fire and the smoke need to be a lot bigger? And that doesn't agree with the story, because it's just, you know, the Phoenix Guard is just six characters. It's an assault, but it's not, you know, a war between armies. It's six people against however many Joes are on the rock, and it is an infiltration. And so how do you make an infiltration a successful one, big and dramatic? And I'm not sure you can. So I think, yes, for Duke internally, this is a big upsetting final page. But for me, the reader, it's like, wait, what? So then in the next issue, my note is page 7. Ugh, is Duke holding her chin and kissing her? Gross. And it's not that I have a problem with romance in G.I. Joe comics. It's that, where did this come from? Like, first of all, they have not been flirting with each other. I have not seen any attraction grow between Duke and this woman who, what, she works for, I forget, a nonprofit?
I don't know. It's slightly mysterious. She sort of talks about my employers and things, so I don't know for sure.
I thought when he wakes up and she saved him, I thought she was working for like Doctors Without Borders or something like it. Anyway, so she's upset that she just patched him up and he's about to jump out of a plane, which in and of itself is crazy, and also like parachute into some kind of battle, which is crazy. So stop playing doctor, okay? It's time for me to get back to work. Whatever that is, right? Right. Thank you. And there's this very, I'm sorry, ugly and awkward panel of him, I think having just kissed her on the cheek. And then a very cool pose of him having just jumped out of the plane, sort of sideways. And then like a cool pose of him, you know, diving, except that, you know, his feet in that bottom half splash are like overlapping to panel one. And like that kind of thing always irks me because it's like, I don't know why these feet that belong to someone else are sticking into this panel, you know, but like, don't force this, Joe Casey, please don't force this romance that doesn't add up to anything. And it's not pandering, but it's lazy. And it feels like this 80s action movie thing where the guy is, you know, taking on the bad guys or scaling the mountain or stuck in the Arctic, and there's someone who helps him. And it is a young single woman. You know, it's not like an old man. It's not like some like 13-year-old like in a wheelchair that got abandoned by the previous Arctic, you know, science mission. It's like a 28-year-old PhD, and she's really attractive. And like, of course they have an attraction. Like, you know, usually when I like just go to the store or, you know, like go up a mountain, sort of half of all the people I run into are men. And like half of them are younger than me and half of them are older than me. And this trope of like, well, there's this little attraction. So it's lazy because there's no track laid for it in earlier issues. And so it comes out of nowhere. And so I'm really distracted by how I should feel for Duke, that he's just got to get back to this mission that he's late for. And Casey's on to something. Like, I like the idea that a random good Samaritan finds and helps Duke. And there's the pilot. There's the guy who's, you know, like Duke doesn't go over and like give him a pat on the shoulder. Like, thanks also you.
Doesn't give the pilot a little snog as well. And Miguel is like, elastima.
I'm not expecting Duke to go up and kiss that guy, but I do think, you know, it's like, well, he's doing all the flying, which is actually more dangerous. Anyway, this gets sort of the J. Cordray reverse award for like Tim G.I. Joe Devils Do Outrage is too strong. ire, because it's not that someone is being too sad, whereas no one else is being that sad. It's like the forced romance. And I like a little romance in G.I. Joe comics. Anyway, so enough on that. Am I missing something? Like, were they starting to flirt in previous issues?
Flirt is probably a bit much, but, you know, when you're a hunk of man like Duke. And,
oh, geez.
Yeah, I don't know. So what next?
All right, the actual two pages where Ray pieces together who each of the Phoenix Guard is good. It's these two, one's eight panels and one's a 9-panel grid, and it's almost completely wordless. And this is a place where Josh Medors's straight on shots and like close-ups of hands and close-ups of the monitor that he's seeing and close-ups of a finger tapping a key. I like that Joe Casey gives this reveal this much space. And that even though I think we've figured it out by now, right? But Ray has been such a big deal to the previous series and this series, that to build up for the end of this story arc, his sense of disappointment and just sort of how it breaks him, that it's not like, and it's not a big splash page. You know, if this was the Mark Millar, Brian Hitch Ultimates or like Ultimates 2, this would be a final page splash and it would just be a big headshot of Ray and he'd be saying, no, right? Because you got to sell that original art. But instead we get two story pages with a lot of moments in a row as he pieces it all together. Oh, this guy's this guy. Oh, this guy's this guy. And then when he punches the computer, and I think in a previous episode, I pointed out how silly it was when a G.I. Joe character like punches expensive delicate equipment, and it makes for a great bold visual, you know, in movies, TV, and comic books. You know, I don't think in real life you would do it, particularly if it's something that's, it's like, no, if you punch in a TV, you can, like an old cathode ray tube television, you can shock yourself, right? If it's still plugged into the wall, like don't kick or punch a TV, right? Like on the back of a TV, it says, don't open this. Only an electrician should open this. You might shock yourself and die. But then on the next page, after he punches this computer screen, where's Duke? Mark, where is Duke in this scene?
Well, where is Duke? He? Duke is now in the Rock, and where is he? Oh,
is he in a staircase? Is he in an elevator? Is he in a hallway? Is he in the armory? There are some ridges above him, and there's some smoke below him.
Yeah.
But all right, and that's my last time picking on the storytelling in the story. But what I see there is like, you know, the drawing of Duke is bigger than it needs to be so that there's something a little flashier on the page. But what we needed was Duke to be smaller and there to be more space in that panel for background. And maybe the all the panels get rearranged and that isn't necessarily a vertical up and down panel.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, what we're trying to understand, I guess, is that Duke is, he's parachuted in. There's his parachute in, caught in the tree. He's made his way into the Rock. He can see, you know, some dead G.I. Joe support staff, bullet holes on the wall. He's taking it all in, and he's somewhere near the medical bay where High Tide is bandaging his leg such that then when we do the page turn, he's able to get the jump on High Tide. But
Now that I've been hard on this for several minutes, I will point out pages 18 and 19, we're still on issue 17, the scene where in the vent, Snake Eyes is in the vent looking down and Spirit Iron Knife shows up. That's great. That's great. Joe Casey, Josh Medors, that's great. That over over three or four panels, right? Snake Eyes on the bottom of page 18 pulls up his gun because something's up. And then in the next panel, we're waiting, right? And now he's sort of withdrawn his gun, but it's still in view. And then the panel is comped. It's copied and pasted, and then Spirit Iron Knife is crawling. So they've met up, and they're both. It's like, okay, the guy who sneaks around in G.I. Joe, the other guy who sneaks around in G.I. Joe, and they've both met. And this there's this point of convergence in the story, right? Because we've seen earlier in these four issues that Spirit has to hide, right? Because you know, in previous issues, he got away from the 25-cent issue injuries. Or torture. This scene's great. And then they're both looking down. It's clearly told. The drawings are all good. The sort of the pacing of it and the writing doesn't quite redeem these four issues, but I thought, awesome. That's a cool G.I. Joe scene, a mini scene.
And then we see as the splash page, last page here, Baroness revealing herself out of the bars. Quite a splashy page there. There she is in the orange jumpsuit that was teased in the back of the previous issue. How about we make this little visit a memorable one?
All right, so issue 18. So there's some poses and storytelling things that I don't, I can't get behind. But I want to jump to page 14. Okay, in the middle... In that middle panel, Shipwreck is saying, "Ugh, Scumbag's got us pinned down." They're not taking any cover on this page. I don't understand. Like, no, in this panel, they're going to get shot. They must be getting shot in this exact panel by the bad guy who's shooting right at us. And so here was a scene where, you know, on the previous page, the Joes are running and also pushing Hawk down the hallway. And then they stop because Wild Weasel is across from them and he's got these machine guns And I needed like, I think what I needed in that panel where Shipwreck says, Scumbag's got us pinned down, I needed there to be just like some random trash can or box or Shipwreck to have opened a door to a closet and they're like hiding behind the closet or they've just ducked back around the corner that they came from in the previous page. There isn't actually a corner on the previous page. but I read this page and I thought, oh, they're just ducks in a barrel. They're like 10 feet away. This guy has two machine guns.
Well, this is the thing. He's got two machine guns, two giant like assault rifles, one in each hand, shooting at the Joes. And I think himself, for, you know, he's not being very accurate at shooting these guys, but if you were shooting assault rifles, one in each hand, you know, quite heavy, you've not got one at the other hand stabilizing it, you're probably not going to be very accurate, are you? I think he's just showing off. He's showing off by having two guns and he's shooting all over the place.
Well, because Ray's told them not to kill?
I don't know about that. I don't think they want to listen to Ray. I don't think they give two hoots what Ray's saying to them at this point.
I have lost track of which of the Phoenix Guard are very specifically pushing back on that one. But maybe here, Wild Weasel, yes, there's this thing in movies where when someone is hiding and then they jump out with two pistols, you can't be accurate if you're holding a pistol in each hand. And so you make a good point that if you're holding two machine guns, you really can't be accurate. I feel like this scene is a little artificially sped up and slowed down so that a moment later, Duke can save the day.
True.
I like that Duke saves the day, but it just sort of sticks out at me that Scumbag's got us pinned down. It's like, no, you're not even pinned down. You're just in the open. There's nothing. Like, pinned down implies that you're hiding behind something.
There's a symmetry this to the scene as well, because just a couple of pages earlier in the aircraft hangar, Baroness is shooting, again, dual-wielding two massive rifles at Zorana, and Zorana is able to just run directly at her and then kick her in the face. You're showing off, Baroness, yes, with your two guns. Just stick to one gun at a time and maybe you won't get kicked in the face.
I think this is one of those cases where the writer of this particular story can say to Devil Stew, I'm not a military expert, but I can kind of write that stuff. And a different G.I. Joe writer who does a lot of research and has been in the military would definitely not have these two characters with these two machine guns in this issue. All right, so the president is woken up. He is on the phone with Colton, and then in the White House, because the president sleeps in the White House. The White House is both the presidential office and also the residence, right? You like go upstairs to the bedrooms. So there's this page where a couple Secret Service agents and the president in a bathrobe and slippers run down the hallway and break into a room. And there is Garrett, the real Garrett Friedlow, dead and sort of zombified or desiccated, like his body has rotted, sitting in his chair, and he has a pistol. Looks like he's been deceased for a while, sir. Mr. President, who did this? Somebody we need to... And then on some TV screen, somewhere in the room, I don't know where, Cobra Commander radios them in and gloats. So how do you feel about this reveal of the real Garrett Friedlow?
It's quite cool, but also quite difficult to make a logical sense of, I guess. You know, leaving the dead body of Garrett Friedlow around in the office, it seems like a poor decision if you're trying to, you know, disguise yourself and fit in. I guess the logical... The sort of the step in logic to get here is that maybe, you know, Cobra Commander realizes that he's burnt his bridges and he's making this video to, you know, to reveal himself, and just wants to, I guess, shock his audience by having that dead body. So presumably it has been out of the way somewhere that wouldn't be found, and as part of this reveal, to make his video more shocking, have that dead body there. But yeah. What's with the gun in the hand? I don't know.
Yeah, the gun in the hand is asking a question for which I don't think there's an answer, which I wouldn't do. And, you know, if there had been another flashback, besides, I guess it wasn't a flashback, but the scene where it's Cobra Commander as Friedlow gives his ex-wife a hard time. If there had been another scene like that, where Cobra Commander confronts Friedlow at the beginning, 10 months ago or a year ago, and, you know, ties him up and points a gun at him and says, I'm taking over your life. Or, you know, there's a home invasion, you know, like Friedlow at his home in like Virginia or Maryland. Cobra Commander creeps in and Friedlow points a gun at him and Cobra Commander says, no, I've kidnapped your ex-wife and your kid. I'm going to take over your life. Give me your gun or they're dead. I kind of feel like there's some literary rule about introducing a gun and not doing anything with it in a story. I don't know. And yes, I understand that this is a comic book where lots of characters have firearms. So I think that the visual of the dead body, this ghastly corpse in close up, I think the sort of need, I think the want for it to have this shocking image and this shock to the president, and then Cobra Commander calls in and says, I know your weaknesses, I can exploit them, so even if this particular plot is over, I still win. I have this long-term sword I'm hanging over your presidency and the entire U.S. government. I think in terms of the writing structure of this whole 19 issues, I think you need a scene like this where you have some closure with Cobra Commander and Friedlow, or with Cobra Commander and the president, or all three. I think that this scene is like a lot of these last four issues, sort of too much happens all at once. And some of the sort of comic book visuals or the sort of fun plot points of it go further than like story logic dictate. Like you just said, you know, wait, this dead body, how long has it been here? Like, wouldn't someone have found it? I mean, I guess not. Like, maybe the safest place to hide the dead body you're hiding is in your office in the White House, because only you have the key, because you're the, what is he? It's not the Secretary of State. He's the
Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff. Thank you. What some pages, sort of two pages, if you're, I don't know how it falls in the graphic novel, but if you're holding the comic book, the dead body's on the left and the president saying, son of a, scramble a strike team now, is on the bottom of the right page. So what these two pages say to me is what a lot of devils do, G.I. Joe has said to me, all the way back to the first issues written by Blaylock, that they cram a lot in. You always get your money's worth with a devil's do G.I. Joe comic book. And that's not nothing. There are a lot of comics from all sorts of publishers where, you know, for your hard-earned $2.50 or $3 or $4 or now $5 dollars, you know, you read it really fast. There are a lot of pretty splash pages. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of back and forth. And, you know, 7 minutes later, you think, oh, was that worth $4? So a lot does happen. But I think sort of here's an example of how maybe even one thing too many happens in this scene, which already has a lot of things. The panel after Cobra Commander's communication starts, the president is looking shocked at us, and behind him, his Secret Service has either just opened the closet or the closet has automatically been triggered with Cobra Commander's video like signal. And in it is the like this tech room that we saw in an earlier issue with the mask, the Zartan technology mask. And it looks like this is a whole room where you'd go in and like change your clothes and like do a bunch of makeup. Like this isn't a tiny closet for a hat, or this isn't like a glove compartment in a car. This is like a room in the White House. And so it's like, okay, Cobra Commander is gloating. The president has discovered that the real guy is dead. Do we need to even go a step further and have it explained? Like, oh, it was a mask. Oh, there's a fake door here. There's a closet with a high-tech, like, Dr. Mindbender room in the back in a very small panel, in a pretty packed page.
Mm. I think it, you know, to some degree, it's sort of just trying to put everything in a nutshell. It's like, I'm Cobra Commander. I was Friedlow. Friedlow was an actual person. He's been dead. He's been dead for quite a long time because the body is there and it's quite decayed. And I was wearing a very realistic mask. And here is the mask. It's like sort of just putting everything a little bit in a neat bow to make everything completely clear as to what's been going on, if you ever had any doubt.
Yeah. All right. So getting to the wrap up. So, Mark, how do you feel about the defeat of Phoenix Guard, that some of them get away?
It's just Firefly, I think, that gets away and the rest of them are captured and okay, sort of marched.
One of them gets away. Rey is dejected. Mm. And then there's this talk in the final couple of pages between the Joes and then between the President and Colton. How do you feel about the end scenes?
I mean, it's a little bit talky, but that's okay. I think this dynamic with Rey is interesting, that he's, you know, presented as a kind of a real American hero, sort of true, you know, red, white, and blue running through his veins, and sort of, you know, sort of the ultimate leader, and he's just sort of blindly followed his orders and got himself in this jam, and you know, how does he reconcile all of that? So that sort of aspect of him being dejected is interesting. The sort of dynamic between the President and the Colton is interesting as well. It's almost sort of like mirroring how we began the story with a conversation between Colton and the President, you know, starting with a new, you know, with a fresh start, new leader. They're almost making a second fresh start. The President, similar to Rey, has done an almighty cock up in terms of what he has been doing with his chief of staff and you know, how he's been approaching the G.I. Joe team. Colton's certainly not got everything right either. And they're kind of leaving it on this note of the G.I. Joe team is here to stay. It's here to respond to the Cobra threat and probably grow back up again to closer to the G.I. Joe larger team that we recognize. Own thoughts?
So, yeah, I appreciate you reminding me that these two pages of the President and Colton talking mirrors, bookends the scene at the beginning of issue, I think it's zero. When I was reading this, I found this a little overdone, but I think the structure of the 19 issues really demands it. I think it logically is a good ending. I think when I was actually reading it, I thought it was just sort of just a lot of dialogue, just two pages of guys talking in the Oval Office. And then this final page where Zaymot has the weirdest costume. Is this a costume that showed up in an earlier Battle Lines?
Yeah. Is this a dated esque? I think in the Battle Files entry for Tomax and Zaymot, I think they were wearing this costume. It's one that we've seen before. It's
not good. I'm just gonna be negative. It's not good.
Yeah.
Okay. It's neither fun nor evocative. It just looks like he's wearing a regular shirt and the colorist made a mistake. Mm. It doesn't look. You know what it is? It doesn't look like a decision was made. You know, like the original Tomax and Zaymot costumes. You know, they look like performers. They look like they're in the circus, you know.
Yeah, it's business circus. That's the style they're going for.
Then just put them in their business. okay, so Cobra Commander has a baby,
mm-hmm.
but some scientists, a scientist and also an armed guard, are in front of this baby. So I thought, wait, this isn't the Baroness's baby, because who? Who is this? Who are we supposed to think this is? Or we're supposed to not know?
I think we're supposed to think it's the Baroness's baby. So I think we're meant to draw a sort of a through line from Cobra Commander seeing that file on his computer.
Okay.
Through to that little scene, which I don't know if it made much impression on you, where he's talking on the phone to Blackout. He was run a little mission in the background as the kind of the last act by Cobra Commander in his role of as the, in his White House role, and yeah, that he's sort of got a, you know, loaded something into a helicopter to transport it away. And I think the implication is that Cobra Commander's found out where the Baroness's baby is. He's arranged a transport chopper. He's, you know, authorized it through the White House sort of weight of power, and he has brought it to his Cobra base, and he sees the Baroness's baby as being a very significant pawn in his game.
All right, so like 30 issues ago, Baroness is in a plane that blows up and we think she's dead. And then it turns out she's not, right?
Yep.
And remind me, when do we learn that she is or had been pregnant?
I think we had just found out that she was pregnant just before she blew up.
Okay. What, did she have the baby? Do we know that she had the baby?
So if she was pregnant and a year-ish has passed and then she's in the cell without the baby,
okay,
then
right,
presumably the baby is somewhere else.
Okay, so part of why she's so angry as this illegally held prisoner under the rock is that she doesn't know where her baby is.
Yeah.
But because Joe Casey doesn't want to tip his hand about if there's a baby or where the baby is, he doesn't have the Baroness say anything. When they try to interrogate her, she's just quiet. Hmm.
Yeah. And I think this is kind of the definitive reveal. There is a baby and here it is. Before it wasn't kind of anything was said explicitly. There was just, you know, these different, I guess, breadcrumbs being, you know, suggesting a potential eventuality.
Right, right.
And, you know, and it's, you know, we're still intuiting all of this. It's not, there's nothing, I think, that says it definitively. Yes, the Baroness's baby here in front of me, you know.
It could also just be a Serpentor clone.
Yeah, exactly. It could.
Like there was an earlier story in Devil's Due G.I. Joe where there's a kid, there's a teenager, right? He's a teenager?
Yeah.
He was a clone of Serpentor.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So I want to, a couple overall things. The inside front covers of these four issues tell a little story on their own.
Yeah.
The inside front cover of issue 14 is a normal, we've seen it for the previous year, data desk list of characters of the Joes, who, you know, and they're all active. And then a little bit of a text block for what's happened recently. All right, so that was 15. And then in 16, this is right when the Phoenix Guard infiltrates the rock. And so the inside front cover is all black. And it is a list of lines in white text that says, stop all service, system error. The specified service does not exist. And then there's a larger blue box over it that says system error, address unknown, data desk offline. And then the inside front cover to 17 is, it looks like the Phoenix, it looks like the data desk, but it's just a list of the Phoenix Guard characters, you know, their names, their specialties, their status. And then a box of typed text that tells you what has happened. And then,
as written by General Philip Ray rather than Joe Colton.
Yes, thank you. In the same way that in the back of these issues where there are Phoenix Guard data desk profiles, they are written from Ray's perspective. And then similarly, on the inside front cover to 18, there's another one of these Phoenix Guard data desk lineups with a text summary. And that's a really great detail. That whether you're reading the issues month to month or all in one go, it would only happen in the comic books. They would not be included in the in the paperback collections. And it's a nice, it tells a story, you know, in the same way that in Batman Nightfall, you know, the 19 part story from, what was it, 1993, where Bane lets all the criminals out of Arkham Asylum, and one by one, Batman has to stop them, and then it culminates with Bane breaking Batman's back, and then, you know, Batman 500, double-sized issue, the final part of the story. The logo on the top right of every cover, right after it says Nightfall, there's a little circle with a Batman symbol in it, and it's got a number, one for part one, two for part two, and over the course of the 19 parts, a sort of circle is moving in from the left and basically making it like an eclipse, like a, I guess, a lunar eclipse. And so the icon changes a little bit with every chapter. And that's just a nice little thing that some designer or editor at DC came up with. And so as a little frill, as a little bell and whistle in these G.I. Joe comics, I very much appreciate that extra care. And not just that they did it, but that they did it well. And then again, I'm struck reading these issues in the last page, and the inside back cover mentions a lot of the other things Devil's Due is publishing at this time. And I had forgotten that Devil's Due, I mean, I'm reminded when I read for this podcast, but Devil's Due had the Dungeons and Dragons comic book license at the time. They're doing adaptations of Dragonlance. They're doing adaptations of R.A. Salvatore's Drizzt Do'Urden, Icewind Dale stories, and there are other G.I. Joe things happening at Devil's Due, like the Dreadnoks Declassified miniseries, the G.I. Joe Declassified miniseries written by Larry Hama, another Transformers crossover.
Special Missions and, Antarctica, I believe.
Yes. On the back cover of issue 18, there is a book published by Devil's Due. It's a 32-page single-issue comic book by Tim Seeley. It's called How to Be a Comic Book Artist, Not Just How to Draw. And there's a little burst that says, in the tradition of Josh Blaylock's How to Self-Publish Comics, Not Just Create Them. And there's a description. Veteran DDP staff artist and eternally on-time penciler, Tim Seeley explains to readers how to be a real comic artist with tips on how to get work done right and on time. Also, suggestions for finding and keeping work, avoiding being pigeonholed as an artist, and how to work with editors. And this is one of those things where if I was flipping through a dollar bin and I saw this at a store, I would buy it in a heartbeat. And if I was flipping through just a sort of random back issue bin and I saw it for $3, I would totally buy it. And if I was on eBay buying some like lot of Devil's Due comics, you know, to fill in gaps so I can read comics for this podcast. If this was included, I would think, score, because I am very interested as an artifact, as a historical object. Oh, what was Tim Seeley telling people in 2007 about how he does his job? You know, we've interviewed him for this show, and we were trying to get into his head, like, how did he feel back then? How did it work? And, you know, I keep mentioning things like How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, so I'm definitely interested in other things like that. And I had totally forgotten. I'd remember that Blaylock did his. I didn't even know that Tim Seeley did one as well. And this is one of the many reasons why I like reading the physical back issues rather than the paperback collections for all the added context. What else is Devil's Due doing at the time?
Talking about the physical edition of the comic, Tim, did you notice the switch from issue 14, where they have got self covers for these books? And by that, I mean, same paper stock for the interiors is used for the covers. So a noticeably thinner paper stock on the cover itself compared to the previous issues, where it was a sort of a thicker, not quite card, but certainly a different paper stock to the interiors.
Yes.
And we discussed that with Sam Wells previously, and he told us that it was something that their printers had suggested as a way of saving money by I guess essentially you're able to have a cheaper paper stock but also have a cheaper production process, because you're not having to sort of switch between the covers and the interiors being on different types of paper.
Yeah, it also goes down the line because thinner paper weighs less. So imagine if you've got a couple thousand copies of something and each weighs a tiny bit less. That means your shipping is going to cost less because all of your boxes weigh less, hopefully. The the free comics that your local comic book store or library gives away on Free Comic Book Day or for Halloween, the last couple of years, those have been printed on, and you know, a lot of interior pages that I think Marvel right now are particularly thin. They can hold the color, but they're really thin. Those comics, I think all of last year's were, not every single Free Comic Book Day comic, but many of them recently have been self covers, and you can really tell.
I spy with my little eye.
Some I spies. Did you notice in issue 15 there were a few extra background Joes that we saw?
There were three of them.
Lifeline, Lift Ticket, and Airborne. And this spoke to my discussion with you last time, Tim, where I was noting that Roadblock was slightly uncomfortable flying the helicopter and sticking in these little Easter egg cameos in the background kind of slightly undermines that. When you've got Lift Ticket on staff as a helicopter specialist.
Yes, if you are following along, folks, that those are pages 10 and 11 of issue 15. Just a few pages earlier in issue 15, Yojo Cola. We see Yojo Cola on pages 6 and 7. This is during the card game, and this is I think we've seen Yojo Cola twice before in comics. I think once in Devil's Due and once in Marvel, and I think in both cases we don't really get a good look at it. I think in Marvel, I think it's a Marshall Rogers issue, so it's in, I think it's in the '70s, the number 70s, not the decade. And I think it's a big group shot of the Joes partying at the pit, and you know, on newsprint with old color printing, it's just sort of a red little thing. And here, someone actually did a design. Mm. Someone actually took the italicized military stencil font of G.I. Joe from the cover and made a Y, so it says Yojo instead of G.I. Joe, and combined it with the cola from Coca-Cola and put it on some blue and red with white stripes that curve a little bit like the Cobra, excuse me, like the Coca-Cola dynamic ribbon, that's what it's called. And even though it's cropped out in all these panels are very small when you see it sort of full body, we get an honest to goodness, fully designed Yojo Cola can. So take that, Brian Sauer. Instead of spending all that time and effort just to surprise all of the people who attended Assembly Required in 2022 and to give them an extra bonus at the Friday night dinner, or was it the Saturday night dinner? Anyway, what I'm getting at is that Brian Sauer, who is a convention organizer, a G.I. Joe fan, and an excellent graphic designer, designed his own Yojo Cola label, and it's great. So there's the one that, if you squint, reminds you of Coke, and there's the all-new original one. So, fans, take your pick.
So I spy no letter pages. No letter pages in these, I guess. Normally it's because they don't have enough space or because they don't have enough time. And there's probably a bit of both because they've, you know, these issues are relatively packed and they've got in those data desk handbook entries in the back of them, which is probably supplanting the letters. And then I spy a blinded Roadblock. You see, it seems to be a fairly frequent issue of Roadblock. He was blinded in around about issue 105. He was on the cover there with the October Guard, and there was a bit where one, I think Misha was it, of the October Guard, was on his back, sort of pointing him in the direction he needed to go. And then also, obviously, in G.I. Joe, the movie where he was blinded.
Wait, I can
Cobra Commander.
I can do that line. Let me back up from the mic for the microphone. My eyes! There we go. I can't see. That's a good one. I hadn't realized that this was inadvertently a motif. Three different writers have blinded have all temporarily blinded Roadblock.
I wonder if that was intentional callback or not.
I wonder if the next time there is, you know, the Super 7 deluxe G.I. Joe figures, and the declassified ones come with some Easter egg bits, little accessories. Maybe one of those should come with a little white blindfold to put on the next Roblox figure.
I could imagine that would be the case when they, maybe when they get to the when they get to the G.I. Joe the movie era. I could completely imagine it's the kind of thing they might do, release a Roblox figure with a blindfold and a sort of snake wrapped around him or something.
Maybe he can come with the Devil's Due can of Yojo Cola.
I had an I Spy, a favorite line of dialogue, and an innuendo all wrapped into one one thing. So let's, for old time's sake, let's play the innuendo jingle. This is how the
story goes. Attention. At this moment, you are now listening to
Talking Innuendo.
If you are offended by words like
sucking,
flesh wound,
willy,
Pete,
balls,
crystal balls,
hypno shield,
whatever, take the tape out now. This is not a pop album. And by the way, suck my
grandmother's brick in a Prada handbag.
So, Tim, you're not going to like this, but the line of dialogue is from issue 17. Elizabeth Parker says to Duke...
This is where you're trying to make me laugh.
To my eyes, it looks a little hairy down there, whatever it is.
Man. I'm just shaking my head. Okay, so this episode is two things. It is four more issues of America's Elite at the end of Joe Casey's run. And it's also, we can spend a moment reflecting on the entire Joe Casey run, not just this third arc within it. So Joe Casey is leaving some things for the next writer, whoever that may be, to run with. This promise, this threat from Cobra Commander that he has this sword hanging over the president, the White House, the U.S. government. He knows its secrets. That Cobra Commander has this baby, that the Baroness is out. There's a new status quo for the Joe team, that they're on good terms with the president because the president messed up, and so did Colton. A couple of key Cobra agents are in jail, and a key Cobra agent is not, Firefly. Notably, Joe Casey seems to be sidestepping that Firefly is a ninja in this story. And I think this speaks to Joe Casey having read Devil's Due G.I. Joe and a little bit of early Marvel G.I. Joe in preparation for this run. I don't think Joe Casey read 155 issues of Marvel G.I. Joe in preparation for this run. So I don't think he gets to those Andrew Wildman issues where a bunch of red ninjas are pantomiming like a giant scorpion and Firefly is the stinger tail. And when I was reading the story, in the back of my mind, I thought, oh, right. Part of why I don't think Firefly is a team player enough to do this mission for Cobra Commander is because he's got all this ninja stuff and, you know, animosity towards Snake Eyes or Storm Shadow or Jinx. And, you know, I think that may have, when Hama did that originally in the 120s, that may have been too much. I thought that reveal that it had been Firefly in the photo, the family photo all along, like that really knocked my socks off. At the same time, it started to feel like with that story, you know, if Hama kept writing G.I. Joe for long enough, eventually everyone would have some ninja connection. And here, Joe Casey has just decidedly stepped away from ninja stuff, you know, after the previous story. And there's just this one little scene with Chabang here at the end of this Joe Casey arc with, you know, Josh Medor's drawing. So I think this is a note of continuity where Casey is not using something that had been established. And I get the sense that it's less a choice and more that he missed it, but that's fine. I didn't need another element in these four issues to be Firefly also pulling a sword out as one of the, you know, Phoenix Guard people. Okay, so Joe Casey writes three arcs. And What strikes me most about them overall is that he's off to a great and big start. That the scale of issue zero and issue one, you know, satellites and Chicago and a whole new Joe base and yet a very small Joe team and a new dynamic with Colton in and, you know, Duke and Hawk out. The art at the beginning by Stefano Caselli is so great, and it looks like he has less lead time as those issues go on, and there's an issue that is on draw. Nelson Blake II does good work. It has little flair compared to Caselli, but it's all clear and clean. But in terms of sort of, you know, how I want G.I. Joe to be taken as sort of the most exciting thing, because for me it's the most exciting thing, that second arc drawn by a different artist is a step down from Caselli. And then this third arc by Josh Medors is another step down. I don't think he is as good a storyteller as Nelson Blake II is. And so part of the story of these three arcs, this Joe Casey run for me on America's Elite, is it starts high and it descends. You know, I'm less excited about it as it goes on because the art is less exciting. And I think I said this in a previous episode. I like all of Joe Casey's ideas and his plot. I don't know if when we get to the scripting stage and then someone draws it, I don't know if a lot of it quite works for me as G.I. Joe stories. And I think these 19 issues are a good example of, you know, we sort of always play this game. Like, well, who would write G.I. Joe if it wasn't Larry Hama, right? It's like, who's a new exciting person? You know, like, oh, Chuck Dixon or Greg Rucka, right? Whoever it is, Brian Michael Bendis. You know, you could name 100 writers, people who have done Action Comics, who haven't, who have worked for these publishers, who haven't. And so this is an interesting experiment. I think Joe Casey writes some good G.I. Joe comics. I don't think they're enough of my G.I. Joe, but I appreciate that they are better in some ways than the Blaylock and the Jirwa stuff. And yet also maybe not as good as some of the Blaylock and Jirwa stuff, but then I just sort of get caught up in how I feel, because I was already a big Joe Casey fan going into this when he gets tapped to write G.I. Joe. And I was not a Blaylock fan before Blaylock did G.I. Joe. I didn't know who he was, and I was not a Brandon Jirwa fan. So I think I'm sort of more forgiving of an established writer whom I was already a fan of taking a swing and maybe, you know, only getting a grounder and only making it to first base, as opposed to a Blaylock or a Jirwa who, maybe in terms of their actual G.I. Joe rating, they get to second base. But, you know, listen to all the episodes of G.I. Joe, of Talking Joe Disavowed, and you can hear me sort of never fully loving this publisher's output. So, and then the thing I said at the very beginning of this episode, which is in this issue, in this arc, I can sort of see how plotty it is, and it works very differently than four issues of G.I. Joe by Hama, where these kinds of things would happen. And I don't know if I can explain it any better than that, but there's a looseness to Hama's G.I. Joe stories, and I think that comes from him not knowing what happens next. And sometimes he gets lucky and sometimes he doesn't. Whereas with Casey, it is much more consistent, but it's like, I'm looking at this house that he's built and I can see all the bricks and I can see all the mortar. Like, yep, you built a house. Whereas, you know, this house that Hama builds, I don't know, the analogy is not going to work. It's sort of like a little, it's like my glasses are a little fogged. It's like, I can see they're a house. It's a house. It's a fuzzy house. it's not a good analogy.
The analogy might have fallen apart a little bit there.
I think maybe people who write comics, who write stories might understand this. I can see Casey like setting things up so he can do things. And sometimes it works. And sometimes I don't think he gives himself enough space. And sometimes I think the artists aren't carrying it. Oh, and then one last comparison. Larry Hama's first G.I. Joe arc, continuing the Marvel run for Real American Hero at IDW, when he picks up with the Free Comic Book Day 155 and a half, those first couple issues, I have not read them in a long time, and I did not like them at the time. The ones drawn by Augustin Padilla. Cobra Commander takes the White House. and Cobra sort of becomes in charge. And it's not quite what's happening here with Joe Casey, but that's the closest comparison in G.I. Joe that I can come up with. Like, well, what happens when Cobra gets to the White House?
Yeah, they blow it. Yeah, so I think my thoughts probably echo yours quite closely about the overall sweep of this. It's interesting, you know, just to see this, the sweep of the 19 issues, and it is very much sort of three parts of the three stories being told. They do feel relatively distinct, and I guess the sweeping part of the across it is the smaller team. It's the kind of it's trying to interplay the personalities, ramp up some of the personal tensions, which worked to some degree or not. And probably if, you know, we think about the Marvel story of G.I. Joe, if there's a single character, it's the story of Snake Eyes. For the Joe Casey era, it's probably the story of Colton. We sort of start with Colton taking on the reins. He goes through a bit of a trial of fire, getting used to leading the team, the different personalities involved, the setbacks that he's experiencing, which pretty consistently through it. And then he's left in a place where, again, he's back with the president, looking forward to a new and slightly different era of G.I. Joe. So it's an interesting sort of dynamic to it. It does feel different. The Joe Casey era does feel different to the Brandon Joe era, which feels different to the Josh Blaylock era, which feels different to the way that Hammer would approach things. And they all have their own strengths and weaknesses. Specific to this last arc, it felt like a very different type of story to the one we've seen before. And even if to some degree you could kind of see the mortar in between the bricks, I did enjoy it. I thought it, you know, each time I got to the end of an issue, I did want to immediately get to the next issue and read to find out how it all progressed. And we're left, as you say, at quite a tantalizing place with all of these plot threads that are left open to be explored. It feels like sort of the status quo that the issues finish on gives a lot of room for the next writer to build on and play with. And you know, knowing what is ahead of us, I think to some degree that is what happens, that it's sort of left in a place of quite high tension and stakes, and those sort of stakes are exploited and it's made into a, you know, a very big story of G.I. Joe. And I think the last part of G.I. Joe people do talk about in, you know, with high praise. So looking forward to delving into the second half of the America's Elite run.
What would make a nice object is a paperback collection of America's Elite 0 through 18, including the 25-cent Hunt for Cobra Commander issue. Whether you call it Disavowed or not, I'm not even speaking specifically to Skybound at Image as the new publisher of G.I. Joe. Just as an arc, a bigger, a mega arc of three smaller stories, that it's bookended with this presidential conversation at the beginning and the end. But if you could insert those data desk files in between the issues where they fall in the issues, the same way that you'd include the covers as chapter breaks, I think that would make a really nice object. And if I can wave my comic book talent publishing magic wand, I think, as much as I liked Stefano Caselli's work at the beginning, that there's such a contrast with it and the art that comes later, and that it's such a bummer that Caselli misses an issue or two in his run. I think I would have Nelson Blake II draw all three arcs, not just a fill-in at the beginning and the middle arc. That way you'd have this consistency, because to some extent his stuff actually does look like something halfway between Caselli and Medors, right? His action and facial acting isn't as sexy, doesn't have as much flair as Caselli, but his storytelling and his compositions are stronger than Medors. And one of the things I like about comics is consistency. And, you know, it's exciting when, like, the best artist ever does an issue, and then disappointing when they never come back. And sometimes I think, how would this feel if it had just been not as exciting, but this exciting all the way through? So, and no disappointment, you know, when the younger guy comes along later and finishes the run. I think if someone like a Nelson Blake II had drawn this final arc, 15 through 18, what we're calling the final arc, I think I'd be much more receptive to how Casey wraps up everything.
Interesting. And also in talking about sort of one artist coming along for just an issue and then never coming back, there was that great issue number 12 from Juan Barranco. I think he was a little bit let down by overly aggressive colouring, but that was a great looking issue in terms of his art.
Right.
And we only got one out of him.
Yo, cola, not grape soda.
It's yo, Joe-age time.
So scoring these for me, I like them. Think talked about it enough to sort of not have to go over lots of old ground, but yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was exciting and really enjoyed the arc despite some of the flaws that we've talked about. So maybe 7.5, something like that.
Between the coloring and the art and a good story, but maybe too much happening all at once, I'm gonna give this a 4. Oof. Maybe a 5, you know, but if you have to pin, so I don't do halves. So I'm going to say 4.
Not a man to do things by halves. So thank you, Tim. We're done with those issues and we're done with the Joe Casey era almost, because next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our look at the America's Elite era of G.I. Joe with a special interview with superstar writer Joe Casey.
I am very excited, listeners, that you will be able to cap our look at this Joe Casey era with a nice chat, which manages both. I can imagine this Joe Casey chat balancing both the specifics of writing G.I. Joe and also the generalities of writing.
And after that, we will continue our look at the Devil's Due America's Elite era as it continues with issues 19 and 20, a two-parter called Emperor's New Clothes from editor Mike O'Sullivan, also picking up the writing for this one. And then back over on other shows, we'll be doing all sorts of interesting and fun stuff, including covering A Real American Hero when issue 301 comes out in November. Wow. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now, but remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.